that works for everybody, where equal rights and wage equality are a reality for all of us.
Linda, I got to ask you a question. I know that you are out there on and you're doing yeoman's work, getting the word out, getting women and others. Anybody that's got a mother is eligible to go and work with you. You're doing great work. But what do we have to do to spread the word, to get more people involved? And once we get more people involved, what do we got to do to make the changes we need to here in this country?
Right. Well, there are a lot of pieces to that answer. But, you know, the first answer is that we need to organize. So we need to be sure that people understand the pay gap that exists. Many times, especially younger women, don't realize, you know, I think there is an assumption that because we've passed the Equal Pay Act and the Civil Rights Act and the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, you know, that everything's hunky-dory and that, of course, women are being paid the same as men. And it's through their experience on the job that women come to realize that maybe that's not exactly the case. So, you know, we need to be sure that that women and men get the word about the pay gap and the impact of it. I mean, seriously, families lose up to millions of dollars over a career,
right,
because of the pay gap. And that's money that could help families pay bills today and save for a secure retirement tomorrow. So, you know, it's a big deal. And then in addition to, like, educating folks is to organize them, to take action, to speak out, to share their stories about unequal pay with each other, with the media, with policymakers, and demand that candidates and politicians take a stand in support of equal pay for women. You know, there are efforts going on at the state level. What we really need, obviously, is a law that covers everyone in this country. So, you know, to work toward that, you look at the Congress and you think, wow, well, that's not going to happen. but the reality is that if we organize and, you know, build some momentum, win some victories in the states, and hold those candidates and elected officials accountable for what the American people know that we all need, which is equal pay, that's how we win this.
Hey, Linda, I see on the website that April 15th is an important day for 9 to 5, as well as all of us in the country.
It is. Boy, what a nice setup. This is good. It's actually April 14th.
Ah, that's right.
April 14th is Equal Pay Day, which is a day that is recognized every year to call attention to the pay gap. It represents the day to which women have to work in the new year. So all of last year and up to April 14th in the new year, just to earn on average what men earned in calendar year 2014. It's to really represent that pay gap and to call attention to solutions. 9 to 5 has activities around the country with our union allies, with our community allies, with lawmakers who support what we're doing, with unions, to call attention both to the problem and to the solutions.
Linda, we're coming up against it. We got about 30 seconds left here. How do we find out more about 9 to 5? How can we join?
Yep. Visit 9 to 5. Visit our website at 9to5.org. We are just kicking off our annual membership drive. You can learn about how to join 9 to 5 and get involved in our activities for equal pay, for workplace flexibility, and for equal opportunity on our website. Again, it's 9to5.org.
I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio.
KABU is a proud media sponsor of the August Wilson Monologue Competition. Portland High School students from across the city have been learning their lines and practicing their moves as they prepare to compete in the regional finals of the August Wilson Monologue Competition, to be held March 2nd at Portland Center Stage, Gurdon Theater at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue. Three students will be selected by a panel of judges to participate in the monologue finals on Broadway in the late spring. The August Wilson Monologue Competition. March 2nd at Portland Center Stage, Girding Theater at the Armory. This event starts at 7 p.m.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up.
It's
Labor
on.
Radio.
And good evening. This is Jamie Partridge, your host for Labor Radio. We're on KBOO Portland. Tonight we have a show including speaking with Columbia Riverkeeper organizer and the president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, a Green-Blue Alliance, and followed by Voices of the Night, conversations with graveyard workers. So let's go get going with that first conversation. This is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio, and I'm here talking with Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey of Columbia Riverkeepers and Mike Stanton, who's president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 8. And we're talking about the propane terminal that's proposed to go in right around T6 there on the Columbia River. And we have both an environmental group and a union together in the same room opposing this terminal, which is unfortunately unusual in this day and age, but here's an opportunity to hear what that's about. And let's start out with hearing from Jasmine Zimmer Stuckey about why you're opposing this propane terminal, particularly the as Columbia Riverkeepers. Why are you opposing this terminal?
One of the biggest reasons that Columbia Riverkeeper is concerned about the Pembina propane export terminal at the Port of Portland is the ships that go along with the facility. These ships that are transporting propane up and down the river, you know, to Asian fuel sources or Asian markets, will likely have a security zone around them of up to 500 yards. So that means that the entire Lower Columbia, from the mouth of the river down in Astoria all the way to the Oregon Slough at West Hayden Island, could have a 500-yard security zone when these ships are coming by, which means everyone else loses access to the river. Pembina's proposal could make this happen, you know, 4 to 6 days a month. So for us, this isn't really a debate about, you know, industry versus recreation or conservation. It's about one single industry, the propane export industry, versus everything else on the river, from salmon habitat to recreational boaters, to other industries like agriculture and their ability to access the Columbia River.
So why a security zone?
Across the country, in facilities similar to what Pembina is proposing for Portland, ships have these security zones around them because they're full of liquid propane gas that's highly explosive. It's a security threat. It's a terrorist threat. And while we haven't heard from the Coast Guard yet what the security zone for these ships will be, across the country, we're seeing that likely this will be in place on the Columbia.
Do we have any experience with any of these ships being attacked or blowing up?
Well, the biggest concern for folks who live, you know, 1.4 miles or just a few miles from the facility, and who work near this proposed propane export facility, is the blast zone if there was an accident, an explosion at this liquefied propane facility. It could be, that's one of the things that Pembina has been very quiet about. They haven't come forward with any information about what the blast zone could be, how many communities are in it, how many workers would be part of it. So for folks who live, work, or recreate, near Oregon, on the Oregon Slough, on the Columbia River, near Terminal 6, they could all be at risk if there was an accident at this facility.
Of course, we have seen accidents with oil trains and the fires and blasts that happen as a result of those. And this is much more serious because is it compressed gas or, yeah?
Well, similar to oil trains, propane trains do have a history of exploding. Just you know, a couple of years ago, there were multiple explosions and derailments in Canada. So we could see that, you know, in communities along the rail lines. And of course, most accidents happen in that, you know, process of transfer. So transfer from the rail cars to the tanks, from the tanks to the ships. That means that the Port of Portland site, this Terminal 6 site, is, you know, a high risk area for explosions.
So who is this Pembina, and where is this propane coming from?
So Pembina is actually the largest pipeline corporation operating in the Alberta tar sands, which is known globally for its massively destructive oil extraction practices. So the propane that would come to the Port of Portland would actually be from fracking fields in Canada's Western Sedimentary Basin. So propane as a byproduct of fracking, hydraulic fracturing, comes out with natural gas and then would be shipped to Portland.
So I am assuming that that opposition to the propane export has something to do with opposition to burning of fossil fuels.
Well, Pembina, in addition to wanting to export propane through the Port of Portland, is also the largest player in the Alberta tar sands, which is globally accepted as, you know, the worst form of fossil fuel extraction on the planet. Pembina isn't proposing to export tar sands from Portland, but it's simple economics to understand that supporting this propane export facility that they're proposing at Terminal 6 furthers their ability to profit and increase their overall, you know, expansion and extraction in the Alberta tar sands. So, you know, we're really connecting the dots globally to make sure that, you know, this propane facility, we don't become complicit in furthering Alberta tar sands extraction and fuel transport by allowing Pembina to come here in Portland. The climate risks are severe. Propane is a byproduct of natural gas, and, you know, and in its own right, you know, the propane export facility that Pembina proposes for Portland would account for 0.7% of Portland's actual emissions. So 0.7% of Portland's carbon emissions would come exclusively from Pembina's facility, and that's from the city of Portland's own analysis of this project. If their massive refrigeration processes for getting propane from a gas down to a liquid to store it is a huge energy suck for our city. Furthermore, in terms of the climate impacts and the environmental impacts, propane comes out of the ground when you extract natural gas through the hydraulic fracturing process. Fracking is, you know, also known ubiquitously as a really dangerous extraction technology. You know, cities and states across the country and around the world are banning or passing moratoriums to stop fracking because of its impacts to communities, to water supplies, and to the climate. So, you know, we're really looking at, you know, Portland becoming complicit in fracking for natural gas, for propane, and with companies that are heavily involved in the tar sands.
So proponents of this terminal would say, well, this is going to happen anyway, so why shouldn't it be Portland? Why can't we benefit economically?
I think someone has to take the first step, and Portland is perfectly situated to take that first step and to say no. You know, the simultaneous process that's happening in this city is our climate action plan, which has been developed by, you know, city officials and city employees for years, you know, that says, you know, Portland will reduce our climate emissions, you know, by 40% by 2030 and 80% by 2050, and this is how we're going to do it. You know, that plan is coming out in just a few weeks, and it should lay the groundwork for other cities to make similar climate action plans and to follow through similarly. I mean, and additionally, on the bigger scale, you know, Pembina consistently says they don't want to go through, they can't go through Canadian ports to get this Canadian propane to Asian markets. Well, if they can't do that, then they're going to Portland. And if they can't do it here, then again, it goes back to economics that if they can't ship it, then they can't sell it. and that means that it has to stay in the ground.
All right, so now let's talk to Mike Stanton of the Longshore Union. Why are the longshore workers opposing this terminal, Mike?
The longshore workers are concerned that this will hurt existing jobs because of rail congestion and possibly limit opportunities for future economic development in the area. Longshoremen here live and work in this in this area. They want cargo that will benefit the community. More labor-intensive cargo, cargo like we have now. Pembina's lack information on these security zones and how they will affect the river hasn't told us how that will affect ship traffic for the approximately 9 terminals that we already work at here in Portland. So if any of those have to be reduced or shut down while there's an issue with this facility, that's going to directly affect our jobs.
And there's rail congestion caused by these energy trains as well?
So the railroads earn a premium for the energy trains. Grain and intermodal traffic suffers already, and there's only so much capacity, and it's already squeezed. We've got facilities in Portland that are trying to expand and possibly even double the amount of rail traffic that they need in on commodities that we work now. And with the opportunity of Pembina coming in, there's a possibility that that rail traffic is going to be congested even more. They're looking at 100 unit trains 3 to 6 times a week, and the way that's going to affect any other traffic that's trying to get out, whether it's the autos, the soda ash, the potash, the containers, and the other facilities that are using that rail now.
So usually in this situation, we'd see a union advocating for a new facility because it would be more jobs for your members. But it sounds like you're saying because of the congestion, both on the river and on the rail, that you'd have less jobs.
This facility is proposing that they will have 30-some full-time jobs on a piece of property that should be exponentially more jobs. The initial jobs that they're going to put in building the facility will be good for the trades. That's a plus, but we want to see them building a facility that's going to be something sustainable and something that we're going to keep working with. One of the concerns, this facility is taking over a dock. They're going to be exporting off of a dock that is currently already working. And I'm not sure how those two are going to work together. And Pembina and the port haven't come up with how that is going to function.
So do you want to say anything more about why propane's not a good choice for the Port of Portland?
I covered a lot of that. I think that it takes up space that could be used for more job-intensive cargo, and it shuts out opportunities that might better suit the city. We need to choose carefully. These leases that they get last for decades, and with energy as it is, if something changes or the product's not available or the company isn't shipping it through here anymore because they have another facility, you're going to have a huge piece of real estate that could be used for good working family wage jobs that's going to sit idle through that whole time zone.
Thank you, Mike. So, Jasmine, back to you, Columbia Riverkeeper. What has been the community response to this Pembina's proposal so far?
Easily stated, the community has been incredibly disappointed with Pembina and the Port of Portland. One thing that's been painfully clear is that neither Pembina nor the Port of Portland are prepared to export propane. There was, for example, a September article announcing the lease between Pembina and the Port of Portland that interviewed Port of Portland Director Bill Wyatt and quoted him saying that this terminal would face minimal regulatory hurdles. Meanwhile, Pembina is going to neighborhood associations and testifying in front of, you know, the committees in the legislature, you know, offering, you know, a laundry list of permitting processes and reviews that they must undergo. So what we see from this is Pembina and the port are completely, you know, on different tracks. They're ill-prepared to move forward with this process, and yet they're pushing it through anyway. It's been 6 months since this terminal has been publicly announced, and, you know, without a doubt, it was in the works for many months prior. And, you know, basic information like if there was an explosion, how far away do people need to evacuate? Are the people who live a mile away going to be safe? These ships coming up the river, are they going to impact, you know, our salmon, our river, you know, our river economy? Those things are still unanswered, and it's been 6 months. So we're just seeing, you know, an utter, like, disrespect from these companies, from Pembina and the port, you know, to push this project on Portland residents and workers and expect us to just, you know, sit idly by, you know, while they try and turn us into a fossil fuel export city.
So it sounds like a Port of Portland decision, but I was at a city council meeting where a bunch of people were raising signs that said no propane terminal. What does the city of Portland has to do with this decision?
Pembina is going through a unique process right now. Their propane export proposal actually requires a code amendment for Portland's conservation habitat on the Columbia River. Under the current zoning along the Columbia, it isn't permissible to transport hazardous materials via pipeline through conservation habitat zones. So the first step in allowing or, you know, opening the door to Pembina is for the Planning and Sustainability Commission to recommend the approval of a code amendment. If they do that, then it will go to the Portland City Council for a final vote. So right now we're in the process of, you know, testifying and you know, rallying around the Planning and Sustainability Commission, asking them to, you know, recommend denial of this code amendment. And then if they, you know, if they do that, it will stop right there. And if they don't, the decision will then go, you know, forward to the Portland City Council to make the final decision. So, and again, this process is happening in parallel to Portland's Climate Action Plan, which is slated to be released in just a few weeks, early March. So where you have one branch of the city moving forward with these, you know, nationally acclaimed, you know, climate action policies to make Portland the leader in our nation on sustainability and climate change. You have another branch moving forward with, you know, rolling out the red carpet, changing our environmental conservation codes for a fossil fuel export company. It just doesn't match.
All right. So if our listeners want to get involved, who should they contact? How do they get in touch?
So the way for people to get involved is to attend the upcoming Planning and Sustainability Commission meeting that is specifically for this propane export facility. It's on March 17th from 3 to 7 p.m. at 1900 Southwest 4th Avenue. If you can't make the meeting and you still want to send in your comments or your opinions, you can email them at psc@portlandoregon.gov. That's psc@portlandoregon.gov. And both, you know, the Portland Audubon and Columbia Riverkeeper have lots of information about this propane export facility on our websites.
All right. Thank you. Oh, and Mike, you want to make one last statement about this topic?
Yeah, I just had one more thing to touch on as far as the energy export in general. We have facilities on the river that are already exporting different energy products, and Longview is currently, the Port of Longview is currently proposing a propane facility in Longview, which Local 21 of the ILW has opposed up there, and Local 4 in Vancouver is in opposition of an oil terminal that the port is trying to put in Vancouver. So with all these commodities being exported at the same time, I'm not sure that I'm not sure that all these commodities are going to end up being exported at the same time. So some of these facilities are more than likely unnecessary. And that's what our concern is, that they're going to put something in here that isn't going to be good fit for Portland, isn't going to be what Portland needs. It's not going to be what the local economy needs. It's not going to be what the people here will get a benefit from. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much, Mike Stanton, president of the International Longshore Warehouse Union, Local 8, and Jasmine Zimmer-Stuckey of Columbia River Keepers. If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO Portland Labor Radio, just listening to Columbia River Keeper and the Longshore Union's discussion of a propane terminal on T6. And now we're moving to listen to Voices of the Night, Conversations with Graveyard Workers, our co-host, John Walsh.
So it's 1 a.m. We're working the graveyard shift, taking a little bit of a break. What do people who don't work this shift not understand about it?
It's tough to get your sleeping schedule down.
They expect you to sleep like invisibly at zero amount of hours consumed doing that?
Well, they expect you to be awake when they're awake, because when they're asleep, you're gone and they don't really realize it.
Now, you have a choice about your shift. First shift is the one you'd like to have, right? If possible, the day shift.
Oh, yeah, I'd like to have day shift.
But given the choice, you're still working graveyard rather than swing shift. Why is that?
Swing shift is too hard to maintain a family. You're always gone in the evenings at all times. Day shift is sort of like reverse, or third shift is sort of like reverse day shift. So you can kind of match your schedules with your family better.
So you can see at least some of your family some of the time, right?
Yeah.
What are the positive things about it? There got to be some positive things, too.
It's much quieter on third shift. It's not a lot of bosses walking around, looking over your shoulder. It's more of a relaxed atmosphere. Traffic's nicer.
Parking.
Shopping.
So now, if you were recommended to somebody how to prepare for working graveyard shift, if they have to, what would you tell them to do? What should they think about?
Well, they should think about darkening their room, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
They should think about trying to set a specific sleep time and not just try to cram it in whenever they can. Try to get a routine going down.
You've done this with kids of different ages at home, right?
Yes.
So how does that work? What do you do to adapt to different stages of your kids growing up?
My wife was home most of the time, so it didn't really affect me too much.
You were able to work around that, okay?
Yeah.
Kids didn't come want to play with dad while you're sleeping?
No, they're real respectful. They never come in and wake me up.
Wow.
I know.
Like
it's unique.
Yeah. Okay, now, I mean, what do you think about in general about working graveyard all the time versus changing shifts? You know, people who do that, you know, people who rotate from one to another?
I think rotating shifts is hard on the body. I like to stick with one thing. I know some of the other departments, they sort of rotate around and they just look worn out and tired.
So better, if we're going to do it, better we try and get used to it halfway anyhow, huh?
Yeah, and it takes a while to get used to.
What do you do when you have time off? Do you still sleep in the day or do you...
I can't sleep at night anymore. My body's switched around.
Wow, okay.
I can get a couple hours at night, but I just wake up like it's a nap.
So you still keep your primary sleep time during the day, even if you're not working?
Yeah.
How many years have you been doing this now?
I've been on graveyard for about 4 years.
Okay. But you'd still like to get off it if possible, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't like having to stop whatever I'm doing to go to work at 10 o'clock.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's lunchtime on third shift. What do you think about working this shift?
I like it. I don't like getting up in the morning for day shift, so I can get up, spend a few hours at home, and then go to work.
You didn't always work this shift. Why'd you change to it?
I was working swing shift, and my kids would get home at the time that I left, so I never got to see them during the week.
It makes it tough to have the family situation going well.
Yeah. Yeah, second shift does not work with families very well once the kids are in school. Third shift works. Can sleep while they're at school.
What is it that people who don't work nights don't understand when you're trying to deal with people you know who don't get it? What are the things they have to get explained to them?
They have to learn find out when you're sleeping so that they don't call you and wake you up while you're sleeping. Sometimes they just don't realize why you're so tired all the time.
If somebody was going to be starting to work nights, what would you tell them? What could they do to make it go a little smoother?
Stick with the routine. Go to bed either a few hours after you get home, or give yourself enough time to sleep before work. But stick to the same routine and go to bed at the same time helps a lot.
Okay. Anything else you want to say about night shift?
I think it's really not that bad. It's my favorite shift. It's not for everybody.
All right, thanks.
Okay, we're sitting out here in the dark talking about working the graveyard shift. It's our lunchtime. Why are you guys working this shift?
It's the work we've always worked.
I always need money. I got to pay for my family, my kid.
Okay, what's the good part of it, and what's the not so good part of these hours?
Well, the good part is you get more 12s.
More hours, more overtime.
Bad part is yeah, you sleep all day and I don't get to play with my kid all day, but I get to play with her when I get home, and then I wake up and play for an hour or two and come back to work.
How old is she?
Two and a half.
So she doesn't understand about daddy working nights.
Not yet.
Okay, that part's not so easy. If you had a choice, what would be your ideal shift?
First or second. I mean, first you get the hours still, but when you're in the middle, I mean, you got less people in the building, and you got more people running at night than the guys do on second shift. So, second's just like the fill-ins.
How about sleep? How do people handle sleep? You sleep when you go home? You sleep when you've been up for a while? I mean, what's the...
Immediately.
Right away, you go home, go to bed?
Hello. Get up at 4.
All right. Different people do it different ways.
Yeah, I get to bed about 10, 10:30, and then I wake up about 5.